It is not alive. It is merely used like a puppet to do the wizard's bidding. A ghost, as I trust that you are all aware by now, is the imprint of a departed soul left upon the earth. And of course, as Potter so wisely tells us, transparent.
Snape may do well to set aside his usual Harry-induced sarcasm when discussing Inferi, though, because Harry has already done his homework there. He knows exactly what to expect when he faces an army of Inferi in Half-Blood Prince, all blank eyes and bony hands. Not that knowing what to expect makes the experience any better, but still, Harry is right. They definitely aren't transparent.
An Inferius, plural Inferi, is a corpse that has been reanimated by a dark wizard's curse. It becomes a grisly puppet and may be used as an expendable servant by the dark wizard in question. The most obvious sign that one is facing an Inferius rather than a living human are the white and cloudy eyes. The spells used to reanimate a human body are much more complex than those used, for instance, to make inanimate objects fly. The Inferius may be cursed to respond lethally if disturbed, to kill indiscriminately, and to undertake perilous jobs for its master. Its limitations are, however, obvious. It has no will and no brain of its own, and will not be able to think its way out of unforeseen trouble. As a warrior or guardian with no regard for its own safety, however, it has many uses. The Inferi, whom Harry and Dumbledore encounter in the depths of the lake in Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, were, when alive, mostly vagrant, homeless muggles whom Voldemort had murdered for the purpose during his first rise to power, although some were the earthly remains of wizards or witches who disappeared without explanation. Preserved indefinitely by dark magic, an Inferius can only be destroyed by fire, for no spell has been found to render dead flesh impervious to burning. Inferi are therefore enchanted to avoid flames by their master.
Author's note. Inferi have much in common with zombies, which are mentioned as separate creatures within Harry's world. I had several good reasons for not wishing to call the Guardians of the Locket Horcrux zombies. Firstly, zombies are not part of British folklore, but associated with the myths of Haiti and parts of Africa. While the students of Hogwarts would learn about them, they would not expect to meet them walking down the streets of Hogsmeade. Secondly, while zombies of the voodoo tradition can be nothing more than reanimated corpses, a separate but related tradition has it that the sorcerer uses their souls, or part of their souls, to sustain himself. This conflicted with my Horcrux story, and I did not wish to suggest that Voldemort had any more use for his Inferi than as guards of his Horcrux. Lastly, zombies have been represented and reinterpreted on film so often in the last 50 years that they have a whole raft of associations that were of no use to me. I'm part of the thriller generation. To me, a zombie will always mean Michael Jackson in a bright red bomber jacket. The name Inferius was a play on Inferus, which is Latin for below, but with an obvious connotation of being lesser than a living human. Inferi means the underworld.
Vampires. Vampires don't seem to be a subject of close study in Harry's Defense Against the Dark Arts classes, but two of his professors apparently have some interest in them as a subject. According to Hagrid, Professor Quirrell is never quite the same after meeting some vampires in the Black Forest. And Quirrell's replacement, Professor Lockhart, wrote a whole book about his vampiric experiences called Voyages with Vampires. But since Lockhart co-opted seemingly every tale in his books from other witches and wizards, and Quirrell turned out to have Lord Voldemort sticking out of the back of his head, let's take both those stories with a pinch of salt.
Author's note. Although vampires exist in the world of Harry Potter, as shown by the literature that Harry and his friends study in Defense Against the Dark Arts, they play no meaningful part in the story. The vampire myth is so rich and has been exploited so many times in literature and on film, that I felt there was little I could add to the tradition. In any case, vampires are a tradition of Eastern Europe. And in general, I tried to draw from British mythology and folklore when creating adversaries for Harry. Aside from passing mentions, therefore, the only vampire whom Harry meets in the books is Sanguini in Half-Blood Prince, who makes a faintly comic appearance at a party. Looking back through my earliest notebooks, however, I found that on my very earliest list of staff, there was a subjectless vampire teacher I had forgotten called Trocar. A trocar is a sharply pointed shaft inserted into arteries or cavities to extract bodily fluids. So I think it a rather good name for a vampire. Evidently, I did not think much of him as a character, though, because he disappears fairly early on in my notes. For a long time, there was a persistent fan rumor that Snape might be a vampire. While it is true that he has an unhealthy pallor and is sometimes described as looking like a large bat in his long black cloak, he never actually turns into a bat. We meet him outside the castle by daylight, and no corpses with puncture marks in their necks ever turn up at Hogwarts. In short, Snape is not a revamped Trocar.
Dementors and Chocolate. From Quirrell to Umbridge, Harry's defense against the dark arts schooling is patchy, so thank goodness for Professor Lupin. Not only does Lupin impart useful information about dark creatures, he also, in the words of Hogwarts school nurse Madame Pomfrey, knows his remedies. Offering Harry chocolate after an unexpected Dementor visit is an early example of his teaching brilliance, and a sweet one at that.
The mood-enhancing properties of chocolate are well known in both the Muggle and Wizard worlds. Chocolate is the perfect antidote for anyone who has been overcome in the presence of Dementors, which suck hope and happiness out of their surroundings. Chocolate can only be a short-term remedy, however. Finding ways to fight off Dementors or depression are essential if one is to become permanently happier. Excessive chocolate consumption cannot benefit either Muggle or Wizard.
Patronus Charm. The only way to fight off Dementors for good is the Patronus Charm, and learning to cast it takes time and patience. Again, it is Professor Lupin who teaches Harry the technique, providing him with space to try, a boggart to practice on, and semi-frequent chocolate breaks to rebuild his resilience. If a Dementor sucks hope and happiness out of its surroundings, a Patronus, as Lupin explains, is a kind of anti-Dementor, a positive, protective force that requires the caster to concentrate on a single happy memory. A Patronus is conjured by the incantation Expecto Patronum, but it is famously difficult to master. Harry might get to grips with the Patronus charm relatively quickly, but he is an exception. Even Hermione has trouble with this one. Although the Patronus's primary purpose is to defeat Dementors because the charm takes a form unique to its caster, it is also perfect for sharing sensitive warnings. When Kingsley Shacklebolt's unmistakable Lynx Patronus arrives in the middle of Bill and Fleur's wedding to say that the Ministry of Magic has fallen, it means his message cannot be missed or misinterpreted. Definitely a charm worth perfecting.
The Patronus is the most famous and famously difficult defensive charm. The aim is to produce a silvery white guardian or protector, which takes the form of an animal. The exact form of the Patronus will not be apparent until the spell has been successfully cast. One of the most powerful defensive charms known to wizardkind, the Patronus can also be used as a messenger between wizards. As a pure, protective, magical concentration of happiness and hope, the recollection of a single talisman memory is essential in its creation. It is the only spell effective against Dementors. The majority of witches and wizards are unable to produce Patronuses, and to do so is generally considered a mark of superior magical ability. Some witches and wizards may manage an incorporeal Patronus, which resembles a mass or wisp of silvery vapor or smoke. In some cases, a witch or wizard may choose to produce an incorporeal Patronus deliberately if he or she wishes to disguise the form it generally takes. Remus Lupin, for instance, is afraid that his corporeal Patronus gives too much away. The incorporeal Patronus is not a true Patronus, and while it will give limited protection, it cannot provide the defensive power of the corporeal Patronus, which has the form and substance of an animal. The Patronus charm is one of the most ancient of charms, and appears in many accounts of early magic. In spite of a long association with those fighting for lofty or noble causes, those able to produce corporeal Patronuses were often elected to high office within the Wizen Gamut and Ministry of Magic, the Patronus is not unknown among dark wizards. While there is a widespread and justified belief that a wizard who is not pure of heart cannot produce a successful Patronus, and the most famous example of the spell backfiring is that of the dark wizard Raxidian, who was devoured by maggots, a rare few witches and wizards of questionable morals have succeeded in producing the charm. Dolores Umbridge, for example, is able to conjure a cat Patronus to protect herself from dementors. It may be that a true and confident belief in the rightness of one's actions can supply the necessary happiness. However, most such men and women who become desensitized to the effects of the dark creatures with whom they may ally themselves regard the Patronus as an unnecessary spell to have in their arsenal. No reliable system for predicting the form of an individual's Patronus has ever been found, although the great 18th century researcher of charms, Professor Catullus Spangle, set forth certain principles that are widely accepted as true. The Patronus, asserted Spangle, represents that which is hidden, unknown, but necessary within the personality.
"For it is evident,"
he writes in his masterwork, Charms of Defense and Deterrence,
"that a human confronted with inhuman evil, such as the Dementor, must draw upon resources he or she may never have needed. And the Patronus is the awakened secret self that lies dormant until needed, but which must now be brought to light."
Here, says Spangle, is the explanation for the appearance of Patronuses in forms that their casters might not expect, for which they have never felt a particular affinity, or, in rare cases, even recognize. Spangle is interesting on the subject of those unusual witches and wizards who produce a Patronus that takes the form of their favorite animal.
"It is my firm belief that such a Patronus is an indicator of obsession or eccentricity. Here is a wizard who may not be able to hide their essential self in common life, who may, indeed, parade tendencies that others might prefer to conceal. Whatever the form of their Patronus, you would be well advised to show respect and occasionally caution towards a witch or wizard who produces the Patronus of their choice."
The form of a Patronus may change during the course of a witch or wizard life. Instances have been known of the form of the Patronus transforming due to bereavement, falling in love, or profound shifts in a person's character. Thus, Nymphadora Tonks's Patronus changes from a jackrabbit to a wolf, not a werewolf, when she falls in love with Remus Lupin. Some witches and wizards may be unable to produce a Patronus at all until they have undergone some kind of psychic shock. It is usual, but not inevitable, for a Patronus to take the form of an animal commonly found in the caster's native country. Given their long affinity with humans, it is perhaps unsurprising that among the most common Patronuses, although it must be remembered that any corporeal Patronus is highly unusual, are dogs, cats, and horses. However, every Patronus is as unique as its creator, and even identical twins have been known to produce very different Patronuses. Extinct Patronuses are very rare, but not unknown. Strangely, given their long connection with wizard kind, owl Patronuses are unusual. Most uncommon of all possible Patronuses are magical creatures such as dragons, thestrals, and phoenixes. Never forget, though, that one of the most famous Patronuses of all time was a lowly mouse, which belonged to a legendary young wizard called Ilios, who used it to hold off an attack from an army of Dementors single-handedly. While a rare and magical Patronus undoubtedly reflects an unusual personality, it does not follow that it is more powerful or will enjoy greater success at defending its caster.
Professor Snape describes the dark arts as many, varied, ever-changing, and eternal, and he is undoubtedly right. Snape is one of six professors to teach Harry's Defense Against the Dark Arts class, but if Harry's own experiences on the Horcrux Hunt are anything to go by, even as a collective, they barely scratch the surface of what is out there. Who knows what other creatures might be lurking on the outer edges of the wizarding world, feeding on dark magic? Perhaps Mad-Eye Moody is right to urge his students towards constant vigilance. Chapter 8. Animal Magic. Many of the wizarding world's dark creatures, Dementors, Boggarts, Inferi, exist because they feed on human emotions, or because humans with magical abilities have reanimated them in some way. They are very different, then, from the beasts that live alongside witches and wizards, mostly harmoniously, although it must be noted that Hagrid took it too far when he brought a baby dragon inside his wooden house. From Harry's owl, Hedwig, to Hermione's cat, Crookshanks, to Neville's toad, Trevor, some of the wizarding world's animal species are familiar to muggles, at least at first glance. But other beasts are more obviously magical. The unicorns that live in the Forbidden Forest, the merpeople that live in the Hogwarts Lake? Hagrid's beloved dragons, obviously? Whether familiar or unfamiliar, all these animals have a particular connection to the wizarding world. Let's explore the magical associations of some fantastic, and some arguably not so fantastic, beasts. Thestrals. There are those in the wizarding world who view thestrals as unlucky due to their association with death. But as we will see, these legends are largely unfair. In fact, without the Hogwarts Thestrals' willingness to fly Harry, Ron, Hermione, Neville, Ginny Weasley and Luna Lovegood to the Department of Mysteries at the end of Order of the Phoenix, Harry would never uncover the truth about the prophecy that connects him and Voldemort. He also wouldn't have unwittingly drawn Sirius and other Order of the Phoenix members into danger, but that's hardly the fault of the Thestrals.
Manifesting as black, skeletal, bat-winged horses, but invisible to all who have never been truly touched by death, thestrals have a somewhat macabre reputation. In centuries past, the sight of them was regarded as unlucky. They have been hunted and ill-treated for many years, their true nature, which is kindly and gentle, being widely misunderstood. Thestrals are not marks of ill omen, nor their spooky appearance notwithstanding, are they in any way threatening to humans, always allowing for the fright that the first sight of them tends to give the observer. Being able to see thestrals is a sign that the beholder has witnessed death and gained an emotional understanding of what death means. It is unsurprising that it took a long time for their significance to be properly understood, because the precise moment when such knowledge dawns varies greatly from person to person. Harry Potter was unable to see thestrals for years after his mother was killed in front of him, because he was barely out of babyhood when the murder happened, and he had been unable to comprehend his own loss. Even after the death of Cedric Diggory, weeks elapsed before the full import of death's finality was borne upon him. Only at this point did the thestrals that pulled the carriages from Hogsmeade Station to Hogwarts Castle become visible to him. On the other hand, Luna Lovegood, who lost her own mother when she was young, saw thestrals very soon afterwards because she is intuitive, spiritual, and unafraid of the afterlife. While somewhat intimidating in appearance, these carnivorous horses are emblematic of a journey to another dimension, and reward all who trust them with faithfulness and obedience. Thestrals are native to the British Isles and Ireland, though they have been spotted in parts of France and the Iberian Peninsula. They seem to have an association with wizards who descend from the horse-loving Celtic peoples. Other parts of the world have their own equivalent to thestrals.
Owls. Unlike thestrals, owls are visible to everyone in the magical community, largely because they deliver all the post. They are a network of winged messengers, and every one of them possesses an uncanny knack for finding any recipient. Whether it's the Weasley's ancient owl, Errol, delivering birthday presents to Harry and almost collapsing in the process, or Harry's much-loved snowy owl, Hedwig, finding Sirius without so much as an address, owls are vital to magical communication. In the wizarding world, owls are also much-loved members of the family. Hedwig is one of Harry's most constant companions. From their first meeting in Diagon Alley to their final flight from Privet Drive, she is there for every one of his Hogwarts years and provides a link to the magical world during those interminable summers at the Dursleys. But she is never happier than when soaring joyfully through the sky. As J.K. Rowling has previously said, no owl is happy being shut inside a small cage. So if anyone has ever been tempted to bring one home, please don't.
The old British superstition that it is unlucky to see owls flying by daylight is readily explained. For when wizards break cover to send messages by day, something dramatic must be afoot in the magical world. Muggles may subsequently experience the unpleasant aftershocks without any idea of their cause. As a mostly nocturnal bird of prey, the owl is inevitably seen as sinister by muggles, but it has been a faithful servant and helpmeet to witches and wizards for many centuries. In spite of the many alternatives available for magical communication across long distances, including patronuses, flu powder, and enchanted devices such as mirrors and even coins, the faithful and reliable owl remains the most common method used by wizard kind across the world. The advantages of owls as messengers are those very qualities that make muggles view them with suspicion. They operate under cover of darkness, to which muggles have a superstitious aversion. They have exceptionally well-developed night vision and are agile, stealthy, and capable of aggression when challenged. So numerous are the owls employed by wizards worldwide that it is generally safe to assume that virtually all of them are either the property of the owl postal service of their country or of an individual witch or wizard. Whether because they possess an innate bent for magic, just as pigs are reputed to be innately non-magical, or because generations of their ancestors have been domesticated and trained by wizards and they have inherited the traits that make this easy, owls learn very quickly and seem to thrive on their task of tracing and tracking the witch or wizard for whom their letters are intended. The mystical association between the name and the human who bears it has long been understood by witches and wizards of all cultures. While the process remains mysterious even to those who train up owlets to become wizarding pets or postal owls, the birds appear to be able to make such a connection between the name and its possessor that enables them to trace the witch or wizard concerned wherever he or she may be. An owl does not need to know an address, although witches and wizards generally add the place to the envelope on the off chance that the owl is intercepted and the letter falls into other hands. Should a witch or wizard not wish to be sent letters or tracked in any other way, he or she will have to resort to repelling, disguising, or masking spells, of which there are a great range. It is possible to protect yourself from all correspondence or all but that carried by a specific owl. If a witch or wizard is determined not to be contactable by a persistent creditor or ex-boy or girlfriend, they might try a masking spell specific to that person, but this ploy is easily circumnavigated by asking somebody else to send the owl. In general, It takes strong protective magic and a willingness to forgo a lot of birthday cards to avoid the attentions of Owl Post. Trained owls are expensive, and it is quite usual for a wizarding family to share a single owl, or else only use postal owls.
Author's note. My love of and fascination with owls long predates the first idea for Harry Potter. I trace it to a cuddly owl toy that my mother made me when I was 6 or 7, which I adored. Of course, owls have been associated with magic for a long time and feature in many old illustrations of witches and wizards, second only to cats as most magical creature. The owl's association with wisdom was established in Roman times, for it is the emblem of Minerva, goddess of wisdom. Owl breeds shown within the Harry Potter books include the eagle owl, large, tufted and fierce-looking, owned by Draco Malfoy. The little owl, tiny, cute, but perhaps not very impressive, like Pigwidgeon, owned by Ron. And the snowy owl, which is also known as the ghost owl, Harry's Hedwig. I made a few elementary mistakes when it came to my depiction of Hedwig. Firstly, snowy owls are diurnal, i.e., they fly by day. Secondly, they are virtually mute, so Hedwig's frequent hoots and chirps of approval and comfort should be taken as signs of her magical enhanced abilities. Thirdly, as countless well-meaning owl lovers and experts kept writing to me in the early days, owls do not eat bacon. Hedwig enjoys a bit of bacon rind when she delivers post at breakfast.
Toads. Harry arrives at Hogwarts not knowing much about magic, but thanks to Hagrid, he does know toads are not the most popular pets. "Not a toad. Toads went out of fashion years ago, you'd be laughed at," Hagrid tells Harry, before he pops into Eyelop's Owl Emporium and comes out with Hedwig. Neville, however, either didn't get the memo about toads, or he didn't care. And why should he? One of the first people Harry passes on platform 9¾ is Neville, looking anxiously around for Trevor, his long-suffering and constantly escaping toad.
Of the three approved animals permitted to students as pets at Hogwarts, the toad is, and has been for many years now, by far the least popular. Centuries ago, in bloodthirstier times, when young witches and wizards were expected to personally pop out the newt eyes they were using in potions, they routinely brought boxes of toads to school for use in potions and in other charms. Over time, as the Ministry of Magic introduced legislation regarding animal cruelty, subsections 13 to 29 inclusive, relate to potion ingredients and their production, such practices were gradually outlawed. The toad, never much appreciated for its own personal appeal, gradually appeared, alive, less and less frequently at Hogwarts, unless hopping and swimming wild in the grounds. By the time Harry arrived at Hogwarts, possession of a pet toad conveyed neither cool nor status. Indeed, it was something of an embarrassment. Trevor, Neville's toad, had nothing to commend him except a propensity for getting lost, and when he finally slipped off to join his brethren in the Hogwarts lake, both owner and pet felt a sense of relief.
Author's note. The toad has a long association with witchcraft and was often believed to be a familiar. It occupies a special place in old folk cures, particularly, perhaps on the homeopathic principle of curing like with like in the curing of warts. In the Dark Ages, a British toad could think itself lucky if it died of natural causes, because it was in constant danger of being boiled, powdered, skinned, or tied around a sick human's neck in a bag.
Familiars. Hogwarts may be full of owls, cats, toads, rats, and even some dogs, Fang the Boarhound, Fluffy the giant three-headed creature trained to guard the Philosopher's Stone, Sirius Black in his animagus form. But these are more like pets and less like familiars. Well, except for Sirius. What's the difference between a familiar and a pet, though?
Author's note. The concept of familiars has existed in British folklore for many hundreds of years. Familiars are animals, some say animal-shaped spirits, that serve a witch in various ways, whether as servants, messengers, or even spies. Historical accounts of witchcraft make mention of familiars. Such animals have been credited with supernatural gifts, and even believed to be demons, or the devil himself in disguise. Familiars, in the strictest sense, do not exist within the world of Harry Potter. Although Hogwarts students are permitted to bring animals to school with them, the cats and rats we see there are, broadly speaking, pets. Ironically, the animal that acts most like a traditional familiar in the entire series is Mrs. Norris, who belongs to the castle's only non-magical inhabitant, Argus Filch. It is true that owls are sent as messengers within the series, but this is in the context of a highly organized postal service, not unlike Muggle Pigeon Post.
From Filch's tears over Mrs. Norris when his cat is petrified, to Ron's anxiety about his rat Scabbers, the Wizarding World has many animal lovers. Dumbledore even keeps a phoenix, a creature with a tendency to burst into flames, but that's Dumbledore for you. As Hagrid says, people can be a bit stupid about their pets. And Hagrid would know. Chapter 9. Wizarding Pastimes. Even in the Wizarding World, where school lessons involve magic wands and portraits move and pets spontaneously burst into flame, sometimes you still need to find a way to pass the time. So if you were to pop your head into the Gryffindor common room when Harry Potter and his friends are in residence, you'd find them relaxing in all manner of ways. Ron is partial to wizard chess. Fred and George Weasley like to test out their joke shop products. Hermione reads books, Neville studies magical plants, and Ginny plays Exploding Snap. Meanwhile, away from the common room, there are grounds to be explored and shops to visit. And of course, there is Quidditch. Surely the wizarding pastime to end all wizarding pastimes. Hermione may not be as fully committed to this magical game of broomsticks and quaffles as her friends. It's only a game, isn't it? She says. But many witches and wizards follow Quidditch with a passion, whether they are catching snitches like Harry, hitting bludgers like the Weasley twins, or cheering on from the sidelines like Neville. However they fill their downtime, the magical community has plenty of activities to choose from. Let's fly through some of those preferred wizarding pastimes. And don't worry, we'll end with a trip to the pub. Firebolt. When Professor McGonagall introduces Harry to Gryffindor Quidditch Captain Oliver Wood at the beginning of his first year, the Firebolt, a state-of-the-art racing broom with an acceleration of 0 to 150 miles an hour in 10 seconds, has yet to make its debut in the window of Diagon Alley's Quality Quidditch Surprise. So when Harry makes his own debut as Gryffindor Seeker, he does so flying a Nimbus 2000, a reliable broom that serves him faithfully until its untimely destruction at the branches of the Whomping Willow. When he finally gets his hands on a Firebolt, though, owning one of the fastest brooms in the world certainly does no harm to Harry's reputation as Seeker. What makes this broom so special, then?
In the late 20th century, the Nimbus Racing Broom Company dominated its competition. The Nimbus 2000 and 2001 models outsold all other top-class brooms combined by a factor of 3 to 1. Little did the Nimbus designers realize that a racing broom was in development that would knock them from their number one spot within 12 months of its release. This was the Firebolt, a top-secret project developed by Randolph Spudmore, son of Abel Spudmore of Ellerby and Spudmore, who produced the Tinderblast in 1940 and the Swift Stick in 1952, both serviceable brooms, but never achieving great popularity. A skillful and innovative broom designer, Randolph was the first to use goblin-made ironwork, including footrests, stand, and twig bands, the secrets of which are not fully understood, but which seem to give the Firebolt additional stability and power in adverse weather conditions, and a special non-slip foot grip that is of particular advantage to Quidditch players. The handle is of polished ebony, and the twigs of birch or hazel, according to personal preference. Birch is reputed to give more oomph in higher sense, whereas hazel is preferred by those who prefer hair trigger steering. The Firebolt is a costly broom, and Harry Potter was among the first to own one. It continues to be made in relatively small quantities, partly because the goblin workers involved in the patented ironwork are prone to strikes and walkouts at the smallest provocation.
Gobstones. Compared to wizarding chess, where a bad move might result in a player's chess piece being violently taken down by an opponent, gobstone sounds like it should be a gentler alternative. But unless you're playing an actual life-size game of wizard chess like Ron does in Philosopher's Stone, chances are you won't actually be physically discomfited by a wizard chess piece. Not so with gobstones, however. These marble-like stones have a secret weapon all of their own.
Gobstones is an ancient wizarding game that resembles marbles, the principal difference being that every time a point is conceded, the winning stone squirts a foul-smelling liquid into the loser's face. Players start the game with 15 small, round gobstones each. Gobstones are sold in sets of 30. And the winner must capture all of his opponent's stones. Though most commonly, as the name implies, made of stone, gobstones may also be made of precious metals. Professional gobstone players compete in national leagues and international tournaments, but it remains a minority sport within the wizarding world and does not enjoy a very cool reputation, something its devotees tend to resent. Gobstones is most popular among very young wizards and witches, but they generally grow out of the game, becoming more interested in Quidditch as they grow older. The National Gobstone Association has attempted recruitment campaigns such as Give Gobstones a Second Glance. Although the choice of accompanying picture, current Gobstones world champion Kevin Hopwood being squirted with an eye full of gunk, was perhaps ill-chosen. Gobstones enjoys limited popularity at Hogwarts, ranking low among recreational activities, way behind Quidditch and even wizarding chess. The mother of Professor Severus Snape, Eileen Prince, was president of the Hogwarts Gobstone Club in her time at school.
The Leaky Cauldron. As with Hogsmeade's The Three Broomsticks, the Leaky Cauldron is a pub popular with witches and wizards of all ages. Harry spends significant time there as a young Hogwarts student, and many adults also enjoy a beverage at the historic bar. When Hagrid brings Harry into the pub early in Philosopher's Stone, Barman Tom asks Hagrid if he wants his usual tipple, so presumably he is a regular. As the gateway to Diagon Alley, the Leaky Cauldron is the scene for Harry's very first foray into the wizarding world, a sort of grubby alleyway between Muggledom and magic, which makes its Charing Cross Road setting seem particularly fitting, as we will discover. Anyone for a drink?
Some people argue that the oldest pub in London is the White Hart on Drury Lane. Others, that it is the Angel on Bermondsey Wall, or the Lamb and Flag on Rose Street. All of these people are muggles, and all of them are wrong. But the oldest pub in London, as any wizard will tell you, is the Leaky Cauldron on Charing Cross Road. The Leaky Cauldron was there long before Charing Cross Road was even planned. Its true address is No. 1 Diagon Alley, and it is believed to have been built sometime in the early 1500s, along with the rest of the Wizarding Street. Created some two centuries before the imposition of the International Statute of Secrecy, the Leaky Cauldron was initially visible to Muggle eyes. While the pub was, from the first, a place for witches and wizards to congregate, whether Londoners or out-of-towners up for the day to shop for the latest magical ingredients or devices, Muggles were not turned away or made to feel unwelcome, even though some of the conversations, not to mention pets, caused many a wary drinker to leave without finishing his mead. When the Statute of Secrecy was imposed, the Leaky Cauldron, great British wizarding institution that it had become, was granted special dispensation to continue its existence as a safe haven and refuge for wizard kind in the capital. Though insistent on many powerful spells of concealment and good behavior from all who used it, the Minister for Magic, Ulrich Gamp, was sympathetic to the need for wizards to let off steam under the difficult new conditions. He further agreed to give the landlord of the day responsibility for letting people into Diagon Alley from his backyard, for the shops beyond the pub were now also in need of magical protection. To honour Gamp's protection of the pub, the landlord created a new brand of beer, Gamp's Old Gregarious, which tasted so disgusting that nobody has ever been known to finish a pint. There is a 100-galleon prize to anyone prepared to do so, but nobody has yet succeeded in claiming the gold. The Leaky Cauldron faced one of its most difficult challenges in the late 19th century with the creation of Charing Cross Road, which ought to have flattened it completely. The Minister for Magic of the day, the tediously long-winded Faris Spavin, gave a melancholy speech in the Wizengamot explaining why the Leaky Cauldron could not, this time, be saved. When Spavin sat down 7 hours later, having finished his speech, he was presented with a note from his secretary explaining that the wizarding community had rallied, performed a mass of memory charms. Some say, to this day, that the Imperius curse was used on several Muggle town planners, though this has never been proven. And that the Leaky Cauldron had been accommodated in the revised plans for the new road. Certainly, the Muggle architects involved never did understand why they had left a gap in their plans for buildings, nor why that gap was not visible to the naked eye. The Leaky Cauldron has changed little over the years. It is small, dingy, and welcoming, with a few bedrooms above the public bar for travellers who live a long way from London. It is the ideal spot to catch up with wizarding gossip if you happen to live a long way from the nearest magical neighbour.
Author's note. Charing Cross Road is famous for its bookshops, both modern and antiquarian. This is why I wanted it to be the place where those in the know go to enter a different world.
From transfiguration to charms to creating the perfect potion, learning to perform magic can be hard work. It's no wonder those in the wizarding world have their own unique ways of blowing off steam. Competitive sports played on broomsticks, chess games where the pieces have a mind of their own, marbles that spit, oh, and trips to the pub, because sometimes winding down with a drink in a friendly spot is all the magic you need. Chapter 10. Fame in the Wizarding World. Harry's first visit to the Leaky Cauldron, itself a famous place according to Hagrid, gives Harry an early clue about his own fame. As the pub falls silent and its patrons trip over themselves to shake his hand, Tom the barman greets Harry with tears in his eyes, saying,
"Bless my soul, Harry Potter. What an honour."
But Harry is never comfortable with his fame. He particularly dislikes being revered for an event he has no memory of, and this discomfort continues throughout his life. Harry refuses to engage with those who want to use his fame for their own gain, like Professor Lockhart. He resists Daily Prophet reporter Rita Skeeter's attempts to paint him as a tragic hero, and he is resolutely unenthusiastic about Professor Slughorn's attempts to make him star of the Slug Club. As anyone who recalls Lockhart, Rita Skeeter, and Slughorn will know, Harry's attitude is not typical of every member of the magical community. There are others who work hard to achieve fame, and there are many who follow those famous people's achievements. Molly Weasley loves both Lockhart and singer Celestina Warbeck. Ron is an avid follower of Bulgarian Quidditch player Victor Crumb. Then there are the many Weird Sisters fans, including Parvati Patil and Nymphadora Tonks. And so it goes. But as Lockhart says, fame's a fickle friend. And the Wizarding World celebrities are just as susceptible to its ups and downs as those in the Muggle world. Celestina Warbeck. A fixture on the Weasley family radio, Celestina Warbeck is a particular favourite of Ron's mother, Molly. Her music formed the backdrop to some of Molly's happiest times, as Molly reminisces one Christmas.
"Oh, we danced to this when we were 18, said Mrs. Weasley, wiping her eyes on her knitting. "Do you remember, Arthur?"
Not everyone is such a fan. Molly's future daughter-in-law, Fleur Delacour, calls Celestina's festive broadcast horrible. If the following glimpse into Celestina's backstory is anything to go by, though, it doesn't seem Fleur's opinion would cause her any sleepless nights.
Internationally acclaimed singing sensation Celestina Warbeck, sometimes known as the singing sorceress, hails from Wales. Her father, a minor functionary in the Department of Muggle Relations, met her Muggle mother, a failed actress, when the latter was attacked by a Lethifold disguised as a stage curtain. Celestina's extraordinary voice was apparent from an early age. Disappointed to learn that there was no such thing as a wizarding stage school, Mrs. Warbeck reluctantly consented to her daughter's enrolment at Hogwarts, but subsequently bombarded the school with letters urging the creation of a choir, theatre club, and dancing class to showcase her daughter's talents. Frequently appearing with a chorus of backing banshees, Celestina's concerts are justly famous. Three devoted fans were involved in a nasty three-broom pile-up over Liverpool while trying to reach the last night of her flighty Aphrodite tour, and her tickets often appear on the black market at vastly inflated prices. One reason why Molly Weasley has never yet seen her favourite singer live. Celestina has sometimes lent her name and talents to good causes, such as raising funds for St Mungo's Hospital for Magical Maladies and Injuries, with a recording of Puddlemere United's anthem, "Beat Those Bludgers Back, Boys, and Chuck That Quaffle Here." More controversially, Celestina was vocal in her disagreement when the Ministry of Magic sought to impose restrictions on how the wizarding community was allowed to celebrate Halloween. Some of Celestina's best-known songs include "You Charmed the Heart Right Out of Me" and "A Cauldron Full of Hot Strong Love." Her fans are usually older people who love her grandstanding style and powerful voice. The early 21st century album "You Stole My Cauldron, But You Can't Have My Heart" was a massive global hit. Celestina's personal life has provided much fodder for the gossip columns of the Daily Prophet. An early marriage to a backing dancer lasted only a year. Celestina then married her manager, with whom she had a son, only to leave him for the composer Irving Warble 10 years later.
Author's note. Celestina is one of my favourite offstage characters in the whole series and has been part of the Potter world ever since its inception, making an early appearance in the short-lived Daily Prophet series I produce for members of the equally short-lived fan club run by my British publisher, Bloomsbury. Although I never lay eyes on Celestina during the whole 7 volumes of the Potter books, I always imagined her to resemble Shirley Bassey in both looks and style. I stole her first name from a friend with whom I worked years ago at Amnesty International's headquarters in London. Celestina was simply begging to be scooped up and attached to a glamorous witch.
Nicholas Flamel. Nicholas Flamel is the alchemical partner of one Albus Dumbledore, a fact revealed by a chocolate frog card during Harry's very first journey on the Hogwarts Express. Harry, Ron and Hermione later also discover Flamel is 665 years old and famous for being the only known maker of the Philosopher's Stone, an artifact that causes a lot of trouble in Harry's first year. But who is this infamous alchemist?
Author's note. Nicholas Flamel was a real person. I read about him in my early 20s when I came across one of the versions of his life story. It told how he had bought a mysterious book called the Book of Abraham the Jew.
which was full of strange symbols and which Flamel realized were instructions on alchemy. The story went that he subsequently made it his life's work to produce the Philosopher's Stone. The real Flamel was a wealthy businessman and a noted philanthropist. There are streets in Paris named after him and his wife, Perronelle. I remember having a highly detailed and exceptionally vivid dream about Flamel, several months into the writing of Philosopher's Stone, which was like a Renaissance painting come to life. Flamel was leading me around his cluttered laboratory, which was bathed in golden light, and showing me exactly how to make the stone. I wish I could remember how to do it.
Alchemy. Obviously, it is impossible to say whether the real Nicholas Flamel successfully produced the Philosopher's Stone, but the Nicholas Flamel in Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone certainly did. Otherwise, he definitely would not have reached the age of 665. This is because Flamel's Philosopher's Stone, created through a process known as alchemy, produces the Elixir of Life. This elixir, according to one of Hermione's library books, makes the drinker immortal. The whole immortality thing is also what makes the stone attractive to Voldemort, who is then only half alive because he effectively possesses Professor Quirrell. It is a dangerous thing to have hanging around. Outside the wizarding world, did the Philosopher's Stone ever exist? Or was it more symbolic? And what does the study of alchemy have to tell us about Harry's story?
Author's note. Alchemy, the search for the Philosopher's Stone, which would turn base metal to gold and give the possessor eternal youth, was once believed to be possible and real. However, the central quest of alchemy may be more complex and less materialistic than it first appears. One interpretation of the instructions left by the alchemist is that they are symbolic of a spiritual journey, leading the alchemist from ignorance, base metal, to enlightenment, gold. There seems to have been a mystical element to the work the alchemist was engaged upon, which set it apart from chemistry, of which it was undoubtedly both an offshoot and forerunner. The colours red and white are mentioned many times in old texts on alchemy. One interpretation is that they, like base metal and gold, represent two different sides of human nature, which must be reconciled. This was the inspiration for the Christian names of Rubius, Red, Hagrid, and Albus, White, Dumbledore. These two men, both hugely important to Harry, seem to me to represent two sides of the ideal father figure he seeks. The former is warm, practical, and wild, the latter impressive, intellectual, and somewhat detached. Although there are books on alchemy in the library at Hogwarts, and I always imagined that it would be studied by very clever students in their 6th and 7th years, Hermione most uncharacteristically ignores the opportunity. Perhaps she feels, as Harry and Ron certainly do, that, far from wishing to make another Philosopher's Stone, they would be happy never to see another one in their lives.
Gilderoy Lockhart. Celebrity is as celebrity does, is another choice phrase spouted by Harry's second defence against the dark arts teacher, Gilderoy Lockhart. And if anyone in Harry's life knows what celebrity does to a person, it's Lockhart. Dark arts champion, renowned author, and 5 times winner of Witch Weekly's Most Charming Smile Award, Lockhart has a talent for self-publicity that is completely at odds with Harry's ambivalence towards his own fame. It's a shame for Lockhart, then, that he could never hope to emulate Harry's level of renown. But he certainly does a great job in constructing his own narrative. Is that what celebrity does to you?
Early life. Born to a witch mother and a muggle father, with 2 older sisters, Gilderoy Lockhart was the only one of his parents' 3 children to show magical ability. A clever, good-looking boy, he was his mother's unashamed favourite, and the realisation that he was also a wizard caused his vanity to blossom like a particularly pernicious weed. School. The young Lockhart's arrival at Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry was not the triumph that he and his mother had expected. Somehow, Lockhart had not appreciated that he would be in a whole school full of witches and wizards, many of them more accomplished than himself. In fact, he had visualized for himself an entrance into Hogwarts, not unlike the one that Harry Potter experienced decades later. He had imagined walking down the corridors to excited whispers of his magical prowess, it never having occurred to him that every student at Hogwarts had had similar experiences before starting school. In Lockhart's own mind, he was already a fully fledged hero and genius, and it was a most unwelcome shock to discover that his name was unknown, his talents were unexceptional, and that nobody was particularly impressed by his naturally wavy hair. This is not to say that Lockhart had no talent. Indeed, his teachers felt that he was of above-average intelligence and ability, and that, with hard work, he might make something of himself, even if he fell short of the ambitions he shared freely with classmates. Lockhart told anyone who would listen that he would succeed in making a Philosopher's Stone before leaving school, and that he intended to captain England's Quidditch team to World Cup glory before knuckling down to becoming Britain's youngest Minister for Magic. Sorted into Ravenclaw House, Lockhart was soon achieving good marks in his schoolwork, but there was always a kink in his nature that made him increasingly unsatisfied. If he was not first and best, he would rather not participate at all. Increasingly, he directed his talents towards shortcuts and dodges. He valued learning not for its own sake, but for the attention it brought him. He craved prizes and awards. He lobbied the headmaster to start a school newsletter because he liked nothing better than to see his name and photograph in print. Never very popular, he nevertheless achieved his primary goal of school-wide recognition through repeated detention-getting exploits. He received a week's worth of detentions for magically carving his signature in 20-foot-long letters into the Quidditch pitch. He managed to create a massive, illuminated projection of his own face, which he would send skywards in imitation of the Dark Mark. He sent himself 800 Valentine's cards one year, which caused such a pile-up of owls in the Great Hall that breakfast had to be abandoned. Far too many feathers and droppings in the porridge. Post-Hogwarts career. When Lockhart finally left Hogwarts, it was to a faint sigh of relief from the staff. He was soon heard of in foreign parts, where his exploits began garnering increasing publicity. Many of his ex-teachers began to feel that they might have misjudged him because he was demonstrating both bravery and resilience in ridding various far-flung places of dangerous, dark creatures. The truth was that Lockhart had found his true calling at last. He had never been a bad wizard, only a lazy one, and he had decided to hone his talents in one direction, memory charms. By perfecting this tricky spell, he had succeeded in modifying the recollections of a dozen highly accomplished and courageous witches and wizards, allowing him to take credit for their daring exploits, returning to Britain at the end of each adventure with a new book ready for publication, which retold his feats of bravery with a wealth of invented detail. Within a decade of leaving school, Lockhart had achieved bestseller status with a series of autobiographical books and a reputation as a world-class defender against the dark arts. He even received the Order of Merlin, third class, became an honorary member of the Dark Force Defense League, and his good looks untarnished by the many life and death tooth and claw battles he claimed to have had with werewolves, banshees and the like, won Witch Weekly's Most Charming Smile Award no less than 5 times in a row. Return to Hogwarts. Many staff were baffled as to the reason that Albus Dumbledore chose to invite Gilderoy Lockhart back to Hogwarts as defense against the dark arts teacher. While it was true that it had become almost impossible to persuade anybody else to take the job, the rumor that it was cursed was gathering strength both inside and outside Hogwarts. Many teachers remembered Lockhart as thoroughly obnoxious, whatever his later achievements. Albus Dumbledore's plans, however, ran deep. He happened to have known two of the wizards for whose life's work Gilderoy Lockhart had taken credit and was one of the only people in the world who thought he knew what Lockhart was up to. Dumbledore was convinced that Lockhart needed only to be put back into an ordinary school setting to be revealed as a charlatan and a fraud. Professor McGonagall, who had never liked Lockhart, asked Dumbledore what he thought students would learn from such a vain, celebrity-hungry man. Dumbledore replied that there is plenty to be learned, even from a bad teacher. What not to do, how not to be. Lockhart might not have been keen to return to Hogwarts, given how well his career of stolen glory was progressing, had Dumbledore not dangled the promise